All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining the Return to Service podcast. I'm joined by Hayden Lowe, the Vice President of AvFab, or Aviation Fabricators. Thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris. I told you before we got on here, I'll say it so that everybody can hear it now, we're going to need your best today. Everything you can do to make sure that this goes as well as possible, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, well, and to give people some context, we're both dads with pretty young kids, so it seems we were both up in the middle of the night last night, so it's good to have a fellow tired person running through this with me, so I appreciate you being in the fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I guess just to kick it off, all right, so AvFab, what do you guys do? Who do you guys serve? What are the kind of problems that you're solving for people? Let's kick it off there, and then just kind of want to get your feedback on how you run the shop, what you look for, things like that. But let's start off with AvFab first.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a little company history and try to move quickly through it, but I think it gives a bit of background and is informative into who we are and who we try to serve. So back in 1979, there was a really windy night in Olathe, Kansas, and a 1959 172A flipped over at the airport, and it was salvaged. And 6 months later, the insurance company sent out postcards to all of the pilots in the area and said they were going to have an auction for this airplane. You know, it's salvaged, but anybody can come and bid on it on this day. My dad was 14 at the time, and my grandpa was a pilot, and he got the mail that day. And my dad at 14 was already really interested in aviation. My grandpa, he himself was a second generation pilot. So, you know, they both have this love for aviation. And my dad takes the postcard to my grandpa and he says, hey, we should go bid on this. I think that there's a way that we can make money parting this thing out. We can sell the tires off of it. We can sell, you know, different components. He doesn't have any money, but my grandpa's willing and they decide that they're going to go to this auction together. So they do. They get this 1959 172A. They part it out. They make just a little bit more than they paid for it. But it started at the time, what was Central Air Motive. And it was a company that did just that. They found salvaged airplanes and then parted out the components to try to make a couple of dollars. Over time, there was the realization that the interiors were sort of the neglected part of the airplanes. Everybody wanted, you know, to work on engines or landing gear or whatever else, but nobody liked dealing with seats or tables or anything on the inside of the airplane for that matter. And so that, you know, there's a niche there. So they started really focusing their salvaging of, or their, you know, their auctions and the airplanes that they were buying on where they could make money on interiors that they were reselling. As that progressed, it became Aviation Fabricators. And that's when the company went from salvaging aircraft to manufacturing and repairing different components. So at this point in time, so that's the roots of the company, that realization that there's this missing component for interiors. And then in the 90s, it became, you know, an STC holder for a certain number, or about 150 parts from the 90s to present. And then the certified repair station really took off. At present, we're working on everything from Cessna 152s to G650s, but mostly smaller airplanes. And when I say working on, let me be pretty specific. We never touch airplanes. We only touch the components within those airplanes. So seats and couches and toilets and tables and window shades, et cetera. And on the repair side of things, which is about 60% of our business, that's across the board. On the STC PMA side of things, we're only manufacturing parts through, for like the legacy jets, the, what we refer to as the 9G aircrafts, those that didn't have to be dynamically tested. So up through the Citation 560 Encore and older. And then most of our STCs are focused on the King Airs, Pipers, the, you know, some of the, a lot of propellered aircraft.
Okay. Okay, nice. So, and then, so today, let me make sure I got this right. So 60% is on the, what's the split? 60 and 40, yeah. What is the split?
Yeah, I kind of dropped off there before I went back and made it clear. So I would say 60% is on the certified repair station side of things. So toilets, window shades, hydrolocks. So like the when you go to recline your seat in an aircraft, you know, that's what engages to allow for you to recline. We overhaul about 5,000 a year. A whole bunch of different smaller random components, coffee brewers and microwaves and ovens and hot liquid containers. And then the 40% of the other side of the business is the manufacturing of, you know, STC products. So those products, you know what an STC is. I'm not going to explain it to you. And that would be, yeah, King Air seats, King Air couches, King Air tables, interior upgrades, as well as some components are just... I wouldn't even call them improvements, just replacements for OEM parts. Yeah, PMAs.
Yeah, got it. So I guess looking at those, and actually funny enough, I was in Dallas last week and I was in a parts room visiting with a customer, and I looked down at the parts tag and I see AvFab. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, we work with them. And he's like, oh, well, and I actually tell him I'm gonna do a podcast with them next week. He's like, oh, tell him. I said, thank you for doing all these, he's like coffee machine and the hot water tank repairs. He's like, these guys are a lifesaver. I love working with these guys. So just a little feedback from the field. But so you've got, all right, so you have these two sides of the business. I guess just from a high level, maybe we can dive into one of them. What are the similarities between the two? But then also what are the differences in the way that each of these businesses function? Because it might be part of the same thing, but I imagine there's got to be some overlap, but there's got to be a decent amount of nuances between one from the other. So what are like the high level things that you've noticed?
It's a good question. It's probably not one that I can give a great answer to. You know, so the way that we think about the business is sort of, there are people who certainly overlap and touch both sides of things, but there is a lot of, we've sort of separated the workforce. I mean, where 60%+ even of people are more focused on the certified repair station side of things, than on the STC PMA, you know, manufacturing side of things. I probably 60% of my job is sales, and that's all on the STC PMA side of things. We have another guy who's almost exclusively on the certified repair station things. So the similarities, I mean, you know, when I think about like the inspections, you know, what it takes to get something out the door, the paperwork, et cetera, there's a lot of similarities there, but the differences are pretty significant. And I think that's Ebis, you all have had to work with us, you know, a lot to make this work for us, because our business is a little bit unique in that we have such differences in the way that we operate, you know, just from one order to the next because of the certified repair station to STC PMA differences.
Yeah. Okay. So let's focus on the PMA side, since you're primarily focused over there. So when you're going through, you're doing these different like seat assemblies, you're doing these interior upgrades. I saw some of those videos where you like almost refurbed like the entire inside of a King Air. That end result looked pretty awesome. So focusing on that side, when you go to work with customers, How do you understand, okay, what do they need? What are they looking for? How do you kind of diagnose that side? And then once you understand that, how does that flow through the design phase, go into production? How does that get back? Like, what is that life cycle like? How does that all happen?
Okay. this is a good place to spend some time, but it's unfortunately much less professional than I wish it was. It's not so much of a science, and I don't know that that's all a bad thing, but there are certainly some misses because it's not. How do we come to, you know, I think the first part of that question is sort of like, how do you arrive at a problem that you want to solve for?
Yep.
Well, I mean, I mentioned 1979 was the start of the business. 1981 was technically when AFAB opened its doors. So 44 will be 45 years of the company this coming year. Through that time, we've been really fortunate to create some really good relationships. And I say we, and that wasn't me at all. My dad and my grandpa, they did a great job of cultivating some really strong relationships with some people who are touching airplanes all the time and who are really good at interior work. They're experts at their in their field. So like I saw you had Rod Caldwell on from Flightstar. Rod's an expert when it comes to the Lears. I mean, he knows the Lears really, really well. And I'm sure other things too. I just know him in regards to the Lears. Kent Rose at Rosewood Interiors. Those guys know King Airs really well. They know Citations really well. I could think of a good handful of others. I mean, Elliot and Stevens and, you know, those guys. And we have a really good working relationship with Textron. So there's a lot of names that come to mind, and I won't list them all. But I bring that up because of those relationships, we're fortunate to be told of a lot of problems that the people doing the work on the airplanes are encountering. So there's a lot of conversations of,
okay,
hey, we, you know, this monogram toilet is, you know, it's always a problem. I guess we're focused on the SEC PMA side of thing, but we'll just hang out in this example.
Either
for a
way.
Second.
Yeah.
It's a consistent problem. Have you guys ever looked into solving for it? Is there something you can do? Because, you know, the OEM new kit is $25,000, and we just think that's ridiculous. And people are electing to not get their toilet repaired at all or replaced. They're just not having a toilet anymore because the cost is so outrageous. On the STC side of things, it's difficult to be an expert across a large number of airframes. And so we've tried to become experts really just in the King Air space. And so I mentioned, you know, some of those names like Kent Rose at Rosewood Interiors and you know, Ken Kleehammer and Timmy Godfrey. I mean, there's a Stevens and man, the good people at Elliott. Those guys, they all know King Airs as well. Megan Welch and Adam Doyle. And so that airframe being around since 1965, I think, when the first King Air left Wichita to present, there's a lot of interior problems that have surfaced over the years, which means there's been a lot of need for solutions. But then also the interiors of, like, let's just say the 200, for instance, which has been produced since 1973. I mean, 50 years in, what it left the factory at then to now is drastically different. And so still a great airframe. You can do a lot regarding the, you know, the engines, the avionics, et cetera. We get good ideas from people who say, hey, what if we could do this in the interior and we can make that look like, you know, a factory new King Air. So that's how a lot of that happens. I'll stop for a breath here because I've said a lot. If you've got another question there.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like, okay, it's interesting how these kind of things evolve and the opportunities pop up. So if you're working with somebody like Rod is a perfect example, and actually blowing smoke, but like after talking with him on the podcast, you know, he was like, oh, I know you work with Hayden and AFAB over there. They're great. We've been working with him and then his whole family for a long time. So it's like, clear you guys have those relationships in place, but it's interesting. I bring that up because that seems like a great place to kind of source deals from and start to get that feed of, all right, what are these problems out there with these airframes? How are they showing up in repair stations? What does the operator of the aircraft perceive them as versus when they go in for maybe a medium or a heavy maintenance event and you're pulling something apart, especially on an airframe that might be 30, 40, 50 years old, whatever, you know, whatever age that might be. Like, you almost can't plan when you're manufacturing that for what issues are going to pop up. So is it fair to say that those relationships and those kind of sources are where you guys are getting introduced to, okay, here's some new challenges that we're trying to solve. We want to work with you guys to help us solve it. And that could be any number of solutions. So you have kind of two sides of the business to pull from, right? You have like these manufacturing new pieces of equipment, seat assemblies, things like that. Or it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong there, but as these maybe more technical issues show up, to be able to develop components and ways to service, you know, components, or even maybe even create things that fill a gap that have shown up because nobody could have anticipated this 50 years ago. Is that like a fair assessment?
That's absolutely fair. And I think credit to my dad and my grandpa, I think what they realized is that this world, thinking about smaller general aviation aircraft, you know, in corporate jets, the big boys who are the OEM manufacturers, they don't want to mess with the continuous improvements for these airframes as they age. There's just not enough money there.
Yep.
They're interested in the next, you know, the 560 becoming the 560 XL, becoming the CJ, and producing those components. Yet it is a difficult task to come up with these continuous improvements for these aircrafts that the smallest guys can't do it. So you have to have, you know, the willingness to get your hands dirty and recognize you're not going to make a fortune, but that's okay because that protects you from the guys who do want to make a fortune. But you're big enough that you can, you know, do the hard things and you become experts in the field so that you can solve the problems that the people who you have the relationships with continue to bring to you. But, you know, I mentioned on the front end, this is not a scientific process for us. We've developed an embarrassing number of products that we've never sold. We have a Hawker 800 belted lav. It's seemed really cool. Seemed like it was something that could really be used. We got some feedback. We've never sold one. Market research is a little weak sometimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, market research is pretty tough. And I mean, you guys aren't really a small business, but you're not a massive business. And that's kind of part of the journey. I mean, it even happens in software, right? There's certain things that we build out. We get a lot of feedback from people and they say, hey, we really want something along these lines. And then kind of go through a decent amount of time prototyping and putting things together and making it actually connect from the API to the database. And this connects here and you think it's going to be a great thing. And then you can roll it out and nobody wants to use it, or yeah. you can miss the mark on some of these things, but that's like the art that transfers to a some sort of science down the road, because you can look at something like that and then you can learn the lessons from it and you go, okay, well, we still want to innovate. We still want to move things forward. So we're not going to lose that aspect of it. But what were the things that we didn't pay attention to? I'll use software in this case, that we should have actually validated before we spent any time of this. And then, okay, what can we do in the future to maybe make better mock-ups or get better feedback from people or get more willingness to buy this thing? You know, it kind of sucks when you're in it because it feels like a huge waste of time and it feels like it's very defeating to go through that process of building something and being like, people are going to love this, and then they don't. But if you can do it moving forward and reduce the amount of times that you do that in the future and kind of learn from it, then it's part of the journey. You know, it's not the worst thing. So I guess as you guys go through this process and you build some of this stuff, what one of the vectors is it's coming from people saying, hey, we do have this need in the repair station. So that's one vector. But when you guys come up with these ideas, like how do you go and get feedback from people and start to see, okay, actually this is something valuable. We are selling this. We are moving. I don't need the scientific or like, you know, don't share the dirty laundry if you don't want to, but like, what are some of the things that you look at to assess that?
So, you know, it starts because a trusted source comes to us and they say, you know, we have this problem, or we think that there's an opportunity for someone to introduce this product. And then, you know, we try and usually they're pretty willing, but drag them through the process with us and make sure that, hey, are we developing this, you know, to the vision that you sort of saw, and what about X, Y, and Z that we've thought of along the way, and does that hit the mark? And, you know, we've done a good number of, I'll call them creative things, at least for us, like using message boards to get, you know, feedback, putting polls up on Facebook or like Beach Talk is a website that has a pretty big forum community, you know, just trying to get user input wherever we can. And then as we're developing a product, even well in advance of when it's ready to be released, as I'm talking to customers, you know, if the opportunity presents itself, I'm trying to talk about that and ask them questions. You know, what do you think about this? We think that there's a need. Do you agree with us? And I'll give just one really specific example. We're right now, on the STC PMA side of things, we're developing a medevac seat, actually two seats, a medevac seat and then an ISR seat. And we have an ISR seat right now, but we think that it's lacking in some areas, or at least can be improved upon. And we sort of heard that from some people. So before we ever started the development of the next iteration of that seat, we reached out to all of the people who had that seat, all of the people who have requested a quote for that seat in the past and didn't purchase it. Hey, what do you think about our existing seat? Where could it improve? Where should it improve? Or why didn't you buy it? You know, what would it take for you to look at our seat and say, yeah, this is what we need, because you didn't say that the first time we quoted it? And, you know, collecting all that data and just trying to make sure that we stay the course based off of the feedback that we got from customers and installers.
Yeah, that's pretty key. And then taking it and looking and saying like, okay, really out of all this noise, really it's valuable, but then you got to figure out, all right, what's the real thing that people are looking for? We heard this thing 50 times, so this particular thing is pretty important to people. We heard this a couple, and then I don't know, we heard these 10 things one time from 10 different people, and it's going to be way harder than it's worth to build and to do it at scale and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of interesting. Like, no matter what you're building, that's part of the process, right? Like we had that with, we're building something like the customer portal thing for these quotes and everything. And there was just, I mean, I think I've talked to 60 customers at this point about it. You know, it's been a year, so not like, you know, doing it anyway, but it's been like a year of this feedback and understanding, okay, I've heard this same thing legitimately on every single call that I talk to somebody. This was the concern, whether they said it in the same way or not. That's part of the deciphering process, right? Is like, hey, 30 people have told me this. They've all said it in a different way, but this is like still, this is the main thing they're concerned about. So I don't know, like, I don't know if you want to share it, but as you go through that process, what's kind of your next steps as you get that feedback? What do you kind of do from there?
Well, in addition to seeing, you know, the frequency in which we're getting some sort of feedback, who's it coming from is a big one too. I'm sure you guys deal with that too, but
yep.
If you know, when we're talking about like a an ISR seat, if Sierra Nevada comes and they say, you know, hey, this seat really needs to have this feature, or, you know, Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman, the big boys, if they say it, well, they might need to be the only one who says it for us to make sure that it happens. But, you know, I think from there, what's possible? I mean, I'm sure you guys are doing the same thing, right? Like, you're constantly hearing a bunch of different things, and then you're trying to weigh what's the low-hanging fruit, you know, what's up a little bit higher on the tree but still worth reaching for, and then what's, hey, we just can't do that, or at least not right now. I mean, there's always more that could be done, but, you know, we're running a business, you guys are running a business, and at some point you just have to be okay with leaving some stones unturned because you just can't get to everything.
How does that show up in, like, the manufacturing of seats and things like that? Does it come in the form of, in order to do that and have this be airworthy, you would need to be able to kind of like manufacture this type of assembly in a certain way, but that requires a certain tooling that we don't currently, like, how does that show up in the manufacturing process?
I mean, some of, I think both of what you kind of gave examples to, like in one instance, we'll just use, like, you know, think about seat features. A seat laterally tracks. You might hear from customers, we want a seat that laterally tracks. We want a seat that swivels. We want a seat that reclines. Well, we can do two of those three things. But the third one, if we're going to do the other two, it's going to be really difficult. So, you know, we just can't do all three. And then in terms of, like, you just can't be all things to all people. So, like, in our seats, you know, I mentioned the 9G-16G split. Any aircraft that's parts, that's type certificated after 1992, it's a dynamically certified seat that's installed in those airplanes. So the G load is significantly more. And not only is the G load higher, but the seat has to be energy absorbing. And so, the testing process is much different for a 9G seat. It's a static test, like just a load that's just applied to that seat. And if it can just withstand the poundage, then it passes. But on a 16G seat, it's got to be a dynamic sled test, you know, like what you might see for in a car commercial, like making sure that seat withstands, you know, the abrupt stop at the end, and that the G's are sort of loaded onto the frame and it doesn't fall apart, but yet it absorbs some of itself. Anyway.
Okay.
So a King Air works really well for us to build seats because it's a 9G airplane. But we would love it if our ISR seat was also just ready to go for the Kodiak. Unfortunately, the Kodiak's a 16G airplane. So we just can't do that right now. Now, we might come back to this seat later on, and it's going to be a variation of a clean sheet. But look at, you know, how can we adapt this to a 16G airplane? But right now, it's just too expensive. The amount of time to go to market is too long. You know, we just need to recognize revenue earlier than that. So we just can't hit both airframes at once.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, you know, you've got all these different factors that you got to take into account. You know, it's like, as a small business, as a medium-sized business, you know, the cash flow is pretty critical in all of this. So how do you guys look at that when you look at these new business opportunities? I guess just even from your personal perspective or the company perspective, whatever you prefer, but how do you look at, here's what the opportunity is, here's how long it would take to kind of get a return on that, cash flow is pretty important, what are some of the metrics, what are some of the ways that you think about that?
I think we think about it like, just like you laid out there. The problem is the answers are not always clear. How long will it take to generate revenue off of it? How expensive will it be to develop? That's something that we've realized we're not very good at. And something that only I think we've gotten better at, but we still have a long ways to go. So at the danger maybe of boring you or the audience, I'll just go back briefly. In 2023, we sold a bunch of King Air seats. And when I say King Air seats, they're high density. That's what we call them. I don't know if that's really understood by most people. It's like an airline style, all forward facing seat.
Okay.
And so what it does, like in a 350, you've got 8 seats in the cabin. If you install our forward facing airline style seats, you can put 13 in the cabin. So for
high density, a higher amount of seats in the same amount of space.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's a big deal in, like, you know, you might have minors trying to go to, they've got to travel every day, you know, 30 minutes in an airplane to a mining site. Or it could be, you know, rural Canada. They don't have an airline operations, but the government requires that people are within 90 minutes from this level quality of medical care. And so there's got to be, you know, chartered flights all of the time, and they need, anyway.
Okay.
Well, so, and we are the OEM solution for Textron on high density seats for the King Air. That's great when Textron has a lot of customers who need high density seats. In 2023, they did. But then they signed a great deal for them. The military needed a bunch of trainer airplanes. And I don't remember off the top of my head the exact number, but basically it took up almost all of their inventory for airplanes that we could have a part in for the next 2 years. So 2023, all of these seats to Textron. We knew once they signed that contract, man, we have nothing to offer these airplanes. We're not a part of this conversation. That just went away for the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. And Textron at that time was a really high percentage of our revenue. So we're thinking to ourselves, okay, we've got a bunch of revenue to replace. Because of course, as they have grown, so has our headcount. How are we going to take care of everybody who's here? How can we do that? You know, how can we recognize revenue to replace what we know we're going to lose as fast as possible? Well, some of that was existing products and services that we had that were underperforming. And then some of it was the quickest possible solutions that we could bring to market. So I think I say that because I think to your question, how do you determine, you know, what to go after? Well, in 2023, when we realized what we realized, the solution was, or the answer to what we're going to develop next is what we can make money at the quickest, because that's what the business demands at that point in time. This seat that we're developing now, that's a little bit of a longer term play. We've diversified over the last couple of years. We're not so top heavy in terms of where our customer revenue is coming from. So we feel like we've got just a little bit of breathing room. This is sort of the next iteration, a longer term growth thing that further diversifies, but doesn't require such quick revenue for the business to stay healthy.
Yeah. So, and again, thank you for sharing the details of this, and don't feel like you have to share something that's like compromising. But as you guys look at that and have that realization of, okay, we are pretty top heavy, and we see that this is going to dry up at least for a temporary period of time, at least 2 years, call it, maybe even longer. Where do you guys start looking next? Like, how do you start understanding, okay, we think these areas are successful, we're going to kind of move more into these and split things out, so if this were to happen again, the downstream impacts or the possible, like, we don't want to lay anybody off, we don't want to have these situations where a big chunk of revenue is just gone in a short period of time. So what's that conversation like internally? How do you guys start viewing that, positioning, changing things? Like, how does that all happen?
Right, wrong, or indifferent, the approach that we took was, what's the largest number of airframes that we can service with a high margin product? So, because we felt like, you know, if you're stuck with, you know, there's some pretty low numbers of certain airplanes that have been built. If you're restricted to the, I'm going to throw out a number that's probably wrong, but the 500, 400 series Cessnas, I know there's way more than that now that I say it. If that
pool is too small,
then you're in trouble. And yep. So we really focused on the certified repair station side of things, because that's where, when you develop an STC, it's for a specific model. So you're tied to like the King Air 200. Well, there's 1800 of those. But if you're on the repair side of things, like a Hydrolock, that's in, you know, almost every airplane. So if the Citation 550 begins to be phased out, it kind of is being phased out, the 501s especially. Well, it's okay because new aircrafts are still putting Hydrolocks on the airplane. You know, there's just continuous opportunity that's there. So so we focused on where we could spread the furthest and not be tied to a specific airframe. That was really primarily, this is kind of funny, but Cessna 172 seats, because there's north of 20,000 of them that are articulating double crank and are wearing out really quickly. Well, not really quickly. It's been 60 years, but there's a lot of them that need to be repaired really quickly.
Big influx.
Yeah. And then just window shades across aviation. So almost anything that had a pleated window shade, we begin to focus our repairs on. And so excluding the electronics, you know, there's still a lot of new airframes that are being built with a manual pleated window shade. I'm trying to think now, like the, even some of the newest Gulfstreams and Embraers, I mean, almost exclusively a manual pleated. So that diversification opportunity, you know, those were the things that were going through our heads.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Cause it's that's probably the value of having two different, I guess, business models or types of business, is that, you know, it does, I'm sure, on a day to day or month to month basis, it is probably a pain in the ass to deal with the unique challenges that you guys do of being split in multiple directions. But at the same time, when you do have something, you know, maybe it's not existential, but it could be something that has an outsized impact, like that Textron contract, like drying up, it does give you a decent amount of areas to kind of flex into. And it's interesting hearing, you know, looking at it from one side. So if you've got the STC and you're locked into a particular airframe, you are also locked into the particular size of that market versus a more generic component that might go on any particular any given aircraft. So by nature of it, you kind of open yourself up to having a market that's able to service any number of these makes and models. So that amount of market, if you will, kind of exponentially goes up.
That's exactly right. And okay. Like I'll just tell you, I might sell 12 Citation Divans this year, but there are probably, I'll just take a ballpark guess, there are no less than 1,000 airplanes, and I feel pretty confident throwing that number out there, 1,000 airplanes that are flying right now that need window shades repaired. Moving from 12 to 14, you know, really growing the Citation Divan business, it just doesn't move the needle that much. But when the opportunity is as big as it is with window shades, you can really get aggressive. I mean, so 24, we started cold calling, you know, just the old school. Like we know that our backs are a little bit against the wall. All this revenue's dried up. Give us something to attack and let's attack it. And that's what, you know, the repairs offered for us, a huge pool to fish in.
That's pretty cool. It is a scary thing to kind of have your back against the wall, but to have something to go for and just have a target, and it's like, all right, we got to do this. It's what was the effect on the team? Was it, you know, I assume it was probably pretty scary at some point, but was it like a galvanizing kind of effect?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I would say it was a galvanizing effect. It was also it was a tough time regarding morale to some degree too. Like, we have bonuses that are dependent on, you know, company revenue, and they're everybody's going to get the same bonus based off of the way that revenue performs. And, you know, the guys who are manufacturing parts, they certainly play a role in terms of whether or not we can, you know, hit our goal. But if the business isn't sold, well, then, you know, they're sitting back there like, what the heck? This is unfair. This is hard. But fortunately, we have a really good team. And I know everybody says that about people, but we're really, really fortunate. And we've got a lot of people who have been there for a long time. Clinton, the town that AFAB is in, we are certainly the only business in aviation that is, I guess there's a local mechanic, just I think he works by himself at the airport, but, you know, in aviation, we're the only people working in that space. And we've got a group of people who are really team first and grateful to be a part of it. And they're not looking over at the maintenance shop next door and saying, I could go there and they've got it so much better. So I would say this is kind of a word salad, but I would say it was a galvanizing experience, definitely for the sales team, you know, and the people who were trying to push products. It was a challenging, difficult time, but a lot of good work was the result of it. And everybody had the perspective, I think, that was necessary of, hey, this is frustrating, but, you know, we're going to figure this out.
How did you guys kind of hit, was there like a turning point that you hit after you were like, all right, we're going to go this direction and we're going to lay into it, we're going to do the cold calling? Was there a point where you're like, all right, this is working, like something's working, even if you're making adjustments? But was there kind of a point where you guys realized like, all right, we're on the right path?
No, I'm going to say that it was just it was one of those things. You know, you go and you go and you go, and you're wondering kind of the whole time. And then you look back and you go, hey, you know what? We're making some ground here. And so, like, I'll just tell you, we had two customers who in 2023 made up 43% of our revenue. That number plays over in my head all the time. 43.15%. I think about it constantly. And then 24 was a down year. Like, it was down by like 16.5%. I don't remember that number as well. So we were up 24%, mainly because of two customers who made up 43% of our revenue. And we were down 16%, mainly because of two customers who no longer made up 43% of our revenue. But when we excluded those people from, you know, the total sum of sales, we could see that we were up like 14% across the rest of the business. And okay. You know, it was a whole lot of no's along the way. You know, when you cold call, I don't know if you've ever cold called or if you've ever done.
I've cold called. It stinks. Brutal.
Yeah. It's just like, no, 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 maybe, no, 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 I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel like you're winning. It doesn't feel like there was never a day where all of a sudden I got five yeses in a row and I thought, oh my goodness, this is it. It was just that long, consistent push in the same direction. We're not going to take our foot off the gas. We're just going to keep at it. And things got better, you know? And there was no day where it just all fell through. It just gradually did.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, especially with cold calling, man. I was a sales rep, from 2019 to 2021 at a company. So all through COVID, and there's just like, I remember cold calling during COVID. That was, I got some interesting answers on the phone, like, help yourself. Are you kidding me? But so yeah, man, it's brutal and it's pretty unforgiving, but it is one of those things when you look back and you kind of, if you do put in the effort, you look back, you can kind of see that path of, oh, okay, actually we grew the pipeline by this amount. And actually we've noticed that we're pretty good at winning these kind of deals. And actually we now know that we've got contact info for a pretty big chunk of the market that we think we can like build a whole process around. So it's, yeah, it's nice when you have one of those like realization moments, which is great, but sometimes it is, you're just putting the legwork in and then you look back. I mean, actually that look and seeing, yeah, maybe we were overall down, but without those two customers, everything else is up. That's actually a pretty solid reinforcement that you're going the right direction. Like the diversification's working.
I think one of the things I struggle with, you know, in trying to make business decisions is you want to have the perfect plan in place. You want to have all the variables figured out, all the data points, you know, and you just know that this is the right decision. Sometimes you just gotta go. And that's what, you know, that's what, when I look back at that time, that's what it was. It was just like, hey, we're not, if we sit around and wait for all of the data points to become available and then we decipher everything and we predict just right, it's too late. We can't afford to do that. I mean, there's 34 people and their families, and we just got to do something. And we'll, you know, we're going to make some mistakes, but we'll figure it out along the way. And it just, well, you know, it is what it is. We're just going to go as hard as we can. And so, I don't know. That's a lesson I still don't think that I've fully learned, but that was a big step in, I think, learning that lesson. And I've thought about that a lot since then.
You think that comes from, like, you know, it is a family company, so kind of being tied to the company for a while, seeing the trajectory, and you've got a family too. So having people that work there that have families, like, do you feel like that is kind of played a factor in your decision to do that? Because it's easy to jump ship when things aren't going well too. I mean, that technically was an option. Maybe it wasn't in your head, but technically it is an option. So like, what do you feel like, just from a personal level, kind of made you think that way of, let's just go? I know we can't wait for things to be perfect, but let's just go.
Yeah. I think probably the family side of things did play a pretty big impact. I don't love aviation. I like it. I think airplanes are cool. But I don't love it. My dad, my grandpa, they love airplanes. Like, they always want to be at the airport. They always want to be looking at airplanes. When we're at NBAA, they want to be at the static display. You know, that just gives them energy. I don't get that same thing from it. I am not better than them by any means, but I like people a lot. And that's what gets me excited about working at AFAP. I think that we, if we're doing this right, can provide a good opportunity to people to spend, you know, your work is where you spend more time than anywhere else, except for if you count your sleeping hours at home. I want that to be a good place for people. And we have, man, I'm saying this all wrong, because so do my dad and my grandpa. Just because I don't get super excited about aviation doesn't mean that, you know, that.
No, but I understand it. But look, I have the same thing from this side. I am not a, when it comes to like aviation, I am not like, oh, I love planes. I am super into aviation. But to your point, the thing that I like about being with Ebis, this company, and what I liked about being at Flight Docs when I was there before it sold and everything, was just the fact of, okay, I see people out in the industry, and this might be, you might look at the people that work for you and have this, but I see people out in the industry when it comes to like paperwork and all this stuff, just like spending an inordinate amount of time doing things that they really don't need to be doing. And it's creating all these other headaches and stuff. And I like going and helping people figure out how to solve those challenges and make things better and move things along. And if I can do that well, I like the team that I work with, and I can help them move along and keep their jobs and hopefully make more money each year, things like that. So it's not necessarily that you're saying, oh, like they didn't care about people, but it is, it's like the aircraft side doesn't, it doesn't drive you.
Right. The most exciting thing to me is the people that I work with. I mean, I just, whatever I can do to help those people enjoy their work, make money, you know, utilize their skills. That's exciting to me. So, I don't think I'm unique in that I want to be there for them, because I think they would do the same thing the other way around. I think they had the opportunity, you know, I think about Chuck. He's our best sales guy. Chuck could have left, you know, he could have left at different points, but I don't want to speak words into Chuck's mouth, but I think he thinks, no, let's keep going at this. There's something better here on the other side of things. Or, you know, we just got some really talented guys that I'm sure that they have opportunities that they could go pursue elsewhere, but we're going to just figure this out together. And, so that's a long, really roundabout answer to your question.
It's all right. It's what a podcast is for. Well, I know we're coming up on time, but, before we wrap up, I do want you to tell people where they could find you, but also, is there anything else that you want to touch on before we wrap up?
I don't think there's anything else to touch on. I appreciate you doing the podcast, Chris. I think that it's valuable to hear, you know, other people's perspectives from different places in aviation. I haven't listened to every episode. I told you before, I've listened to a couple of the episodes. So I kind of telling on myself again here, but
it makes you feel better. I don't think I've listened to every episode. So been a part of them, but.
But like hearing you, you know, ask people how they're going to attract talent, you know, for the next generation, as all of this knowledge leaves the workforce, those questions are the right questions to ask. There's value to hearing the answers for all of us. So I appreciate you putting the time into this, and Ebis for, you know, supporting you. And then of course, thanks for asking me to be a part of it, but no, nothing else from my side. You can find me, you can find AvFab at www.avfab.com. You can email me at, hlow@avfab.com. And, yeah, I think we're on all the socials, maybe not Instagram, but I think we're pretty easy to find out there.
Cool. Well, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
You bet, Chris. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks, everybody.